All right, time to bring in Ridley Pearson. Ridley's one of the great crime novelists in America. He cranks out more written material than pretty much anybody I know, and his latest novel is called Killer Summer. It is a crime thriller about a sheriff named Walt Fleming in Sun Valley, Idaho. It is the third in a series. Ridley, welcome back to the Big 550 KTRS. It's nice to have you on.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me. The Young Rascals.
The Young Rascals were on stage with the Beatles.
I didn't know that. I remember them well. We had, I lived out in Greenwich, Connecticut right then, and my older brother, my sister, and I, and some other people had something called The Sound, whose intention was to keep the kids from driving across the New York border and drinking and cracking up on their way home.
Mm-hmm.
So we had live bands once a week at this thing. About 700 kids would come. And our opening band was the Young Rascals.
Wow. Felix Cavalieri and the guys? Yeah, they were.
Exactly.
They were a pretty tight band.
I was feeling. They were just great.
Yeah. They were.
I was at Woodstock, Paul.
You were not at Woodstock.
I was at Woodstock as a 15-year-old lad.
Now, everybody claims that they were there.
I must have been 16 because I drove there with my friends, so I was 16. There were about four of us that piled into a Country Squire station wagon, and we got there on Thursday night, I believe it was, which was well ahead of the highway being shut down.
Yep.
And camped, and everything was kind of normal, and we saw a bunch of bands the next day, and then, you know, it swelled and swelled, and they shut down the highway, and it went nuts, and they broke down the gates. And, you know, I should have probably saved my ticket stub from that thing, because we actually went through a turnstile to get in there, but it was unbelievable.
So you actually had bought tickets and had paid for them, unlike those who got in later for free.
Absolutely. And it just occurred to me now, all these years later, that I probably saved the stub to that once they broke down that, because there was a big cyclone fence around that field.
Yep.
And that baby came down once all heck broke loose, and it was an amazing 3 or 4 days.
I'm sure it was. Now, I talked to a guy a couple of days ago on the show by the name of David Comfort, who wrote a book called The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, and he was talking about how some of these acts were just horrible. That Janis Joplin was on so much booze and so much drugs, and Hendrix the same, that their performances were terrible, that the airplane, Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, said that they did a terrible performance, and Pete Townsend said the same thing about The Who. Do you remember at the time thinking to yourselves, boy, these guys are not doing very well?
Well, I remember that Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I believe they played there. Now, you know, this is my memory, so I may be inventing all this.
No, but they were there.
I think they were there, and I was a musician myself, still am a little bit, and I was amazed how out of tune they sang.
Huh.
I was so disappointed because, you know, that album, that first album of theirs, it was just so crystal clear, perfect harmony.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Nash sang on the top end, and Crosby was in there at sort of high tenor, and it just was flat and off, and I thought, well, how lousy. These guys can't do this live.
That was the first time they'd ever played before an audience together.
Oh, man, how do you know all this stuff? Well, they weren't very good. And I think, wasn't Creedence Clearwater there?
Yes, they were.
And I thought they were fabulous. I thought they were absolutely fantastic. But I remember that the bands that I wanted to sing these close, tight harmonies just didn't do very well. And the more sort of Stones driving rock and roll like Creedence, did very, very well and sounded good in that. You know, I'm not sure anybody had ever played to that size before.
No, I don't think so either.
You know, so trying to make it, you know, people like, one of the big successes of a band like U2 is that they figured out what kind of sound works in stadiums. And as a result, they're an amazingly terrific stadium band.
Yep.
Because they've got that repeating, you know, undulating undersound that Edge gets to all their music, and then Bono can sing on top of that. It doesn't really matter if it echoes around and tangles up, because you've got this wallow sound like Phil Spector under it and a single voice on top of it. It works well in huge, huge amphitheaters. Tight, close, kind of folky, folk rock, Eagleese music doesn't work nearly as well in those huge, huge performances.
And how about when the Rock Bottom Remainders play?
We just, this is a an all, for those of your listeners who don't know, which would be 99.9% of them, I play in an all-authors garage band with Stephen King, Amy Tan, Dave Berry, Mitch Albom, Scott Turow, Roy Blunt Jr. We have a ton of fun, and we play 60s rock and roll, not that you'd recognize it, and we play it really poorly. And so it really doesn't matter whether we play in a living room or a stadium. We just plain sound bad.
But you play well enough that you've had some major rockers perform with you. I know Roger McGuinn was here with you a few years ago, and didn't you do a gig
Roger
with Springsteen?
Still plays with us. Bruce Springsteen has played with us. Roger McGuinn regularly plays with us, which is too bad for his career. Warren Zevon played with us for 4 years.
Wow.
And became a dear friend of all of ours, and that was a huge loss. We've had an awful lot of fun. We do it for good causes. That's the only reason we still get booked anywhere. We just played out here in Sun Valley, Idaho 2 weeks ago, but we've raised about $2 million over our 15 years. And we play three or four gigs a year, and we have a ton of fun, but we've never gotten one bit better. In fact, when we got off stage, Bruce Springsteen came over to us. He'd played Gloria with us, and he said, "Guys, don't ever get any better, or you'll just be another lousy garage band." And that shows you how far down the list we were. We weren't even and still aren't to the level of being a lousy garage band. We're below that.
But you're having fun, and that's all that matters.
That's all that matters, and we raise money, so who cares?
This is the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with novelist Ridley Pearson, whose new book is called Killer Summer, and has been doing pretty well this summer. It's the third in a series that he has written about a sheriff of his hometown now, or his adopted hometown of Sun Valley, Idaho, a sheriff by the name of Walt Fleming. And there are also a couple of teenagers involved in this. I'm curious about the novel business. Do your editors or publishers ever come to you and say, "Ridley, you're a great writer, but we need your books to appeal to a younger demographic, so put some teenagers in there"?
No, they haven't done that. It's really quite the opposite, because I'm a parent and my kids are getting older and older. I write a young adult series or two, one of them with Dave Barry, my co-musician in the Rock Bottom Remainders. And I just find that because I'm surrounded by teenagers and youth, that, you know, you want to write from what you know, and that's what I know right now. So I write the most recent book, Killer Summer, does have a strong foundation in a crime novel, and it's really a heist novel like Ocean's 11 or something. But I did work in a pair of teenagers just because they're familiar to me and I can write from what I know.
And just to give a little plug for the book, give the basic plot, if you would.
Killer Summer is a heist novel. I discovered that Malcolm Forbes in 1985 bought at auction a bottle of wine that was reputedly from Thomas Jefferson's prized collection of wine. Jefferson, as you know, was a wine enthusiast, and when he was ambassador to France, he amassed an enormous collection of wine, and because he was a type A, he accounted for every bottle of that collection. And one of those bottles went on sale in 1985, and Malcolm Forbes bought it for $156,000.
Wow.
A basically 200-year-old bottle of what was probably vinegar.
Yeah.
That intrigued me, and I found that a Midwesterner by the name of Koch, K-O-C-H, had gone on a few years later to buy two more bottles from the same collection through Sotheby's. And then Koch went on to doubt his wine. He just thought, you know what, even though Sotheby's vetted this, I don't believe it. And he spent over $1 million of his own dollars in cooperation with the FBI, running all these fascinating forensics tests on the bottle of wine without ever opening it, and finally determined it was fake, and that Malcolm Forbes and he had been ripped off.
Wow.
And because there is a giant and very popular wine auction in the Sun Valley area put on by our nonprofit, the Sun Valley Center for the Arts and Humanities, and it's become a big ritual in the summer. And I had attended it once or twice. This thing raises like $3 million in a night and becomes a battle of the drunken egos. I thought it would make a really interesting backdrop for another of my Sun Valley thrillers, and that if I could work in that there were these Jeffersonian bottles being auctioned off, maybe they were fake, maybe they were authentic, but no matter what, somebody was going to try to steal them that I'd have a heck of a thriller. So that's Killer Summer.
Now, when you have those disparate pieces of information and you decide, I'm going to put these into a book, there's a wine convention in my town, I'm going to write about the sheriff, we know the story about the Jefferson book, Jefferson bottles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you sit down and you have those disparate pieces of information and you're putting them together, do you know in your head where it's going to end up, or does the story kind of take you there on its own?
Before I start writing, I know where it's going, but that's because I'm an outliner. And so there are vast stretches of time where, in fact, I don't know where it's going, but I haven't started the book yet. So I sit around pounding my head against the wall. And you know, what I really do is I storyboard it, kind of like a screenplay. But I find five or six major scenes that I know have to be in the book at some point, like the wine auction or some other, maybe it's a romantic event, maybe it's showing an early heist. And then I add cards and scenes between those and expand it. And then I add cards and scenes between those. This process might take 3 weeks, it might take 3 months. But finally I know the beginning, the middle, and the end of the book. Now, it might vary from that as I write it, and it often does, and that's fine. But if I get too far afield and don't know where I am, I can always come back to that outline and find my way to a conclusion that makes sense and works. I think we've all been to movies and we've all read books where you get near the end and the whole thing falls apart. Generally, that's because people don't outline.
Mm-hmm.
If you outline and know where it's going, then before that, you can wrap up the subplots, you can wrap up the emotional bits and pieces that you need to, and get to what I hope is a satisfying Big Bang ending.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Ridley Pearson, the author of the new heist novel, Killer Summer. Since you've been doing this for so long, and I've lost track of how many books you've written, you may have as well, but since you've been so successful for so long, I would think that being your editor would be one of the great jobs in America, because I wouldn't have to do all that much.
Well, you'd think, and I appreciate that, Paul, but in fact, Christine Pepe, who's my editor at Putnam, and also Dan Conaway and my agent, Amy Burkhauer, they all make substantive suggestions and changes to the book, sometimes more, sometimes less, but inevitably I go through the whole book 3 to 4 times. And I take a first draft that might be 650 pages and cut it down to about 500 by the end of the day.
Mm.
I've done this my whole career. I've always taken the edits, that is, worked off of them. It isn't that they're always right, but I always think it's worth trying them. Now, some of them I don't keep. You know, even the editor will read a piece that I've rewritten and said, you know, I was wrong. It was better the first time. Let's go back and sharpen that. But I enjoy that process of collaboration and rewriting. I think it's why Dave Barry and I can work together on these Peter Pan books that we write. It's just I'm kind of a band member, a band player. I like collaboration. I like working with other people. And I think if you do that, if you can get your ego out of the way, invariably you get a better product at the end, a better book, a better story, a better screenplay.
Ridley and Dave have written 3 books now in the Peter and the Starcatchers trilogy, but as I pointed out to them last fall when they made an appearance at the St. Louis Public Library here, when you go on to a 4th book in a trilogy, you're essentially proclaiming to the world that 4 is the new 3, and that'll be and that'll be out later on this year. You're actually going to come back with Dave in October for, I don't know if it's October or November, to promote that book. What's that one called?
That's called, it's another Peter and the Starcatchers book, and it's called Peter and the Sword of Mercy. And mm-hmm. Yeah, Dave and I mean, I live in St. Louis, and Dave will come. We will be at the Frontenac Library, I believe it's November 12th. Those are really fun events.
Yes.
Those books have been so much fun for us. They opened up this world of writing for kids. When you go to a book event for kids, they don't ask you about the process or your movie rights or anything. They don't care who you are or how many books you've written. All they do is they raise their hands and they ask questions like, is the crocodile ever going to get off the island?
Mm-hmm.
It's more fun than anything you can ever imagine.
And what else are you working on? Since I mentioned how prolific you are, you must have at least a half a dozen books in the pipeline at this point.
Well, I do. I have in January, I have the second Steel Trap book, Steel Trap the Program, coming out, which is about a 14-year-old kid with a picture-perfect photographic memory. Those are some of my most fun books. And then in April, I have the third installment of the Kingdom Keepers series, which is about five kids who get into Disney World after dark, Disneyland and Disney World after dark, and wreak havoc. And that's become so popular with readers that Disney is actually in the process right now of franchising the Kingdom Keeper series, building this giant website for it, making an international multi-user game, and possibly even bringing enhanced entertainment, they call it, into their theme park. So the Kingdom Keepers piece of my puzzle has become very, very big and is occupying a lot of my time.
Speaking of that, would you mind telling the story of Disney allowing you to go into Disney World and see it behind the scenes, because that's what you needed to know to write the first Kingdom Keeper novel?
And that's the great thrill of the series. Yeah, I mean, when we came up with this idea, you know, how could we write a thriller inside Disney World without really harming any kids or getting a ride into trouble? The way I worked around that was that the kids would be models for a new attraction in the park where teenage holograms guided you through the park. And then the only glitch is that when the teenagers who modeled for these go to sleep at night, in fact, they wake up in the park as their hologram selves. I said I would do this for Disney. They got all excited. But I said the one requirement was that they would have to give me unfettered access to their theme parks. And they did that. In fact, both Dave and I now have VIP passes to all their parks around the world. And one of the offshoots was that I got to go four different times to the Magic Kingdom with the Imagineers, the people who build and design and dream up these rides, and see the park when it was empty. I did the same thing for the Animal Kingdom for the second book, and the same thing at Epcot for Kingdom Keepers Disney in Shadow, which is the April book. It is so fun to be guided into these parks, which are anything but magical when they're empty. They are creepy as all get out when you're in a place that holds 80,000 people and you're the only person in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then they brought in the people who worked the rides, and they allowed me to walk these rides when they were shut down, just under emergency lighting. Then they turned them on, and the ride comes alive, and they let me ride it as the guests would. Then inevitably the guests come into the park about 8 or 9 a.m., and I watched and rode all the rides again with the guests. So it was a multifaceted research program that I do each time I do one of these books. And, of course, I'm having the most fun of anybody on the planet at the time.
It sounds like it. All right, that'll be in January. And then Peter and the Sword of Mercy will be out in October, and he'll be in town with Dave Barry at the St. Louis Public Library on Lindbergh on November 12th.
And in the St. Louis County Library.
County Library. And in the meantime, get his new novel, a heist novel called Killer Summer. This is the always busy and always fascinating Ridley Pearson. Thanks so much for your time today.
Paul, you're the best. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Ridley Pearson here with Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown on the Big 550 KTRS.